All right, guys, it's time to start John here. You know, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are like reading three Gospels that are close enough that it's like, you know, you get the same story. And then John just pops in for something totally different in the Gospel accounts. John is about 92% unique. I haven't done the math. I'm taking the word for other people on that one. But if you read John, you think there's a lot here that's not elsewhere. And there's a lot of church history documents that talk about why John wrote, you know, why is he that he emphasizes this or that or whatever it might be. We don't really know, but we do know John decides to write a gospel that's probably written 60 years post the death of Jesus. John might be, at the moment of writing his gospel, the last surviving apostle. I tend to think he is, and I think this is a late 80s book. Also date Revelation in the 90s, so that sort of gives me my timeline with all of those. So this is one of our last books we have in our New Testament, sort of time-wise. And I think John is writing this late book, and he's going to emphasize some new things about Jesus. And just because the stories aren't the same as Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't mean they're made up. I fight against some of this idea that John writes later, therefore he's not historical. I have biographies in my book that bring up new things because they think they need to deal with the new idea of someone's life. Thomas Jefferson is another guy I like to read a lot about. Jefferson biographies for the first 100 years were always praising Jefferson as being this sort of uniquely minded individual. The last 20 years of Jefferson biographies, if you read one of those and you read one from 150 or 100 years ago, you would almost think it's a different person. Because the last 20 years, it's been a lot more of how do we interpret Jefferson through the eyes of slavery and all the things that are there. Do we still hold this person up, and how do we deal with this real issue? Well, it's not like they've made up Jefferson. It's the same man, but somebody said, we really need to write something about this aspect of his life because it's not been covered and it needs to be, because you can't really study Thomas Jefferson without the idea of slavery and what all went on with that. The same, I think, can be held true with some of these gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, is that you have a story that's very similar, and John is going to write a different story, so to speak, the same person, but his emphasis is going to be much different. I don't think John is making things up, but his emphasis is going to be different and wanting to make sure we get something about Jesus that maybe we didn't emphasize enough. And so John is going to spend more time on the idea of the Son of God. Mark talks about the Son of God. My view is Son of God in John is different than Son of God in Mark. This is another one of these sort of Bible study nuggets I'll throw out. Just because you find the same word in different books doesn't mean they mean the same thing. The idea of popping a concordance up and saying, I'm going to have a study on, you know, righteousness and take one from Matthew and one from Romans and one from James and say they're all equal is missing the point. Again, this is not, we almost a disservice that we have our Bibles this way. It's convenient, but it almost makes us think that we have one book and it's sort of flat when it's not. And so the way the word is used in a particular book needs to be dealt with in that book. Son of God in John is this idea, I think, of a unique Son of God, more so than simply like Mark uses as he's one of these great men that oftentimes in the gospel. So John is going to emphasize more so than the other Gospels the divine nature of Jesus to make sure you get that. And so I want to make that's sort of John's push there. The artist is John. He's called the disciple whom Jesus loved. Three different occasions we find him. He competes with Peter. He normally is more faithful than Peter is in all those occasions. But this is sort of the story of this particular man. That's John. Again, I always say to say Google it, but Google it and you can find out the evidence for why it's John or why it's not John or, you know, why it's Bob. But whatever it is, you're going to find all sorts of things. But the right answer is it's John the Apostle. So if you have any other things you find, they're all wrong. And that one's the right one there. So that's what you got to find. The canvas, again, is ancient biography. John, I think, fits in very cleanly, except for one caveat, is John chapter 1 is a birth narrative, but not the kind of the one you're expecting. Because John's not going to start with, and there was Mary and Joseph, and there was, you know, shepherds and wise men and sheep, and they all seemed to come at the same time, despite 2 years difference, and Jesus doesn't age for, you know, months on end, like you see the normal nativity scenes that we have around here. John is, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And his birth narrative is verse 14, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. Because John, again, is emphasizing the divine nature of Jesus. From a very start point, this one that we know as Jesus, who became flesh and dwelt among us, has existed always as the Word, and the Word was both with God, but he also was God. And therefore, we have this sort of divine push that's going to be made from chapter 1, verse 1. John is like Matthew, in that Matthew's paint for numbers, make sure you get it. John is very similar. Chapter 1, verse 1, I want to talk to you about God who became flesh. Chapter 20, verse 30 and 31, if you don't get why I wrote, let me tell you specifically why I wrote this book. I have found it interesting to me in studying classes, whenever there are books of the Bible where the author says, and I've written this to you so that, and then you get to that part where the professor's like, now I want to tell you the purpose of the book, and they go this long purpose, and I always raise my hand and say, I don't, because you use, well, I have in the past, and then professors don't like that, and so you kind of step back, but you raise your hand, you're almost like, why do you disagree with Peter? And they kind of look at you and say, well, he said this, or do you not trust John? Like, that's sort of that's my mindset. I don't say that aloud too often, but my snarkiness comes out sometimes, in that way, but he just tells you what's about there. So his canvas, again, is this idea of ancient biography. This is what we have here in the Gospel of John. Who's it written for? I think it's written to both Gentile believers and Jewish people of the diaspora past like AD 70. A couple words there I want to define. Diaspora is simply a word that means those who are dispersed across an area. If John is writing in 90, the temple was destroyed in 68, 69 by Titus. John has to explain Jewish customs. And at first you would say, oh, he must be writing to Gentiles because he has to explain Jewish customs. Until you realize he can be writing to Jewish people who are so far removed from temple life and for what's going on in Jerusalem because they were pushed out that they have to have explanations of these customs. You know, if you imagine going back to where I lived in Nashville, 30 years ago was farmland. Now it's this house on top of house and everything's built. And the old timers will talk about such and such place down the street, which was in my lifetime, so to speak, but I was like two and live in Nashville, so I don't know anything about it. But they'll talk about that as if everyone else will know until they realize they don't. They have to explain to you, well, that's where such and such store is at now, used to be this place, and that road that's now eight lane, we used to take our tractors down when I was a kid. And you know, they will explain this because it's changed. Well, if you remove yourself from a land for 30 years, those customs get lost. And so you do have, I think, maybe not just the idea of the Gentiles, but also to those who are sort of set out and maybe those in diaspora. He has to explain customs. He also references the Jews in a way that's interesting. It's not, John uses the Jews as more of a technical term for Jewish leadership. When he points it out there. So you get that idea that's set off. And then you get kind of examples of faith levels in the Gospel of John, which also makes me think there might be a disciples or Christians that John is writing to as well, or those who have some sense of faith. If he is writing, like I think he is 60 years post sort of the gospel being preached in Jerusalem, and you've got a lot of missionary journeys. Like, you know, as a kid, you had those, you know, macaroni missionary journeys you might have done. There's a lot, all those have all happened, and they've been done for 30 years, and you've had the spreading of the gospel for some time. And so you have people who are more familiar with the story of Jesus, but whose faith might not be what it should be. So there's a theme throughout the Gospel of John to where we could also stop and think this is for Christians as well who are, I hate to use it, it's when do they become a Christian, maybe a term for another time, but for people who believe but yet don't have adequate faith, because there's this theme of inadequate faith that runs through John also. So his writing appears to be, to me at least, to Gentiles, both believers and non-believers, and probably to this Jewish audience, whatever's left of Judaism at this point, post AD 70, that might have not know these customs either. It's intended impact. Why did John write? Again, John 20, 30, and 31 is going to be both why he wrote and our sort of way we're going to walk through the gospel here. He wrote so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. And in believing, you'll have life in his name. And John is an evangelistic tract, so to speak. He is trying to bring belief and salvation. He's trying to help people grow in that faith. But he tells you why he's writing. This is, you might believe he's the Son of God, which I think in John has a a deeper meaning than Mark and others. This is the divine Son of God. He wants to make sure you see the divinity of Jesus and that you believe that. That's his impact. I didn't make that up. There's no like, you don't have to believe me on this, because you do, because John said it here. This is what John said in this particular case. He's laying out and saying, this is what I'm trying to make sure you get across in this writing. And so John's writing after everyone else, and there is a question of why does he write this particular book? There is a need, I think, for more stuff. There's more stories here. But also you wonder if John is looking at the faith of those around him and seeing inadequate faith, and so you might be addressing some of that things. If you believe he's the Son of God, there's a greater depth of faith you have to have, but also kind of looking for this sort of evangelistic track as we get out into the new world. And sort of this too is this, John is less tied to an ethnic group, which would make sense in later first century Christianity, that we're not as tied to ethnic group. Because after AD 70, Judaism is, there's not a lot there anymore. I mean, it gets destroyed, and what's left behind is not a huge functioning religion. I don't think we understand the impact of AD 70. There's a reason why when Jesus talks about the destruction of Jerusalem, he uses terminologies like the sky melts and the moon goes dark, because it's not like some, oh yeah, they destroyed a temple. It almost eradicates the Jewish people at that moment in time, because the amount of death, the connection there, and then the going into hiding, because you're now a public enemy there. So this is a huge difference when John writes here. So it's not as much of an ethnic necessity to connect it with Judaism or Gentilism, because at this point you're kind of losing that because of the way the Romans destroyed Jerusalem there by Titus there in AD 68, 69, 70, depending upon which time we move the calendar around. If you ever get those dates, you're like, how was Jesus born in 4 BC? It's because all of a sudden we decide, oh yeah, we forgot to do leap year, we move things back, and you have weird dates. So every time you'll see Jesus is born before he's born, so it's kind of weird, and then you've got these dates of like 70 AD, well probably not, it's probably 68, but anyways, you've got this destruction that takes place. So the intended impact is that Jesus is the Son of God. And then John says, here's how I'm going to prove that. I'm going to walk through these sort of the rest of the time here. He's going to lay out and say, there are signs, there are testimonies, there are personal witness of Jesus. There's this aspect in which he controls time that sort of steps back and says, here's how I will prove that Jesus is who he claims to be. So let's start off with this first idea of how John's going to prove he's the divine Son of God. And it starts off with this idea of signs. And I want to stop for a moment, because in our mindset, we kind of assume signs equals miracles. But you're going to read in the Gospel of John that signs doesn't mean miracles. Signs can be miraculous, but you can also have signs that aren't miraculous that you're supposed to just pick up on. John wants you to think deeper than you normally think. And in fact, I use the word characters. It's not a story, but it's for me, as somebody who likes studying literature, like that's what we talk about. You have characters in the Gospel of John who are real people. So like, well, Wesley thinks it's a made-up story. They have these characters who are used by John to sort of give us an insight to where you get a woman at the well who sees a request of water and thinks, oh yeah, I hate going to this well, give me the living water. Or you get sort of requests of individuals who miss the point because they're thinking at a very surface level and they can't see the deeper truth. Well, signs is a word for John to stop and say, don't think surface about this. And so when he used the word sign, he wants us to make sure you're not thinking at a surface level, because there's something deeper coming along here than simply what you see. There's a deeper truth that's trying to be brought across here. So John will use signs, and there are two categories. There's the miraculous ones that we normally talk about. The first one being John chapter 2, the wedding feast at Cana, where you've got this sign that takes place where the disciples are at a wedding party. The host comes up and she's out of wine, and there's this, you know, worry about Jesus maybe committing things too soon. His mom convinces him to do this particular sign in this place, and so the water becomes wine. The guy takes it, he drinks it, and says, this is shocking. Usually you get the your best stuff first, and after they're well drunk, you give them the less tasting stuff, and that's sort of the point we have here. And John causes a sign in which people believe. And what John, though, is not like, oh, cool, next time we had a wedding party, ask Jesus and he can take care of the refreshments. That's not the point of this. There's something deeper going on here. Or chapter 6, we have the feeding of the of the 5,000, and you've got the ability for Jesus to take on this, you know, particular food and multiply it. He's the manna from heaven. It's not like, oh yeah, again, if you're hungry, go to this guy. He can take your sandwiches and feed the whole crowd. Like, it's not like, here's the guy who's you want to invite to potluck, because he can take whatever's left and make it a great thing there. Well, that's where John wants us, I think, deeper, this idea that signs have deeper truth. So John 6, 5 through 14, the section there about him being the one who is able to bread of life, the bread from heaven. Well, he's picking up on the Old Testament idea of Moses and the manna in the wilderness, and he's laying that out and saying, you had the manna in the wilderness that fed you. I am the true bread of life. You know, unlike Moses's sort of one type of bread, I'm the true bread. True in the Gospel of John is not true in the sense of the other thing was false, but in the sense of this is what's really important. Like, this was pointing to something greater. So that whole manna story, he says, yes, he fed you with manna, but that wasn't really the bread of life you needed, because the only way manna works is you eat that and you still died. In fact, if you read the Wilderness Wanderings, the whole point of the Wilderness Wanderings is to kill everybody. And that's one of those depressing stories of like, all right, you guys sinned, we're going to march till you all die. And you kind of read through that. And children's Bible stories that I read to my kids, I'm always like, man, they really made that story nothing like the Bible. Like Noah's Ark is like, look at the giraffe. They're all smiling. I'm like, where the dead body parts? Like, that's the story is this here. Like, you know, go into the, if you have a nursery that has a Noah's Ark theme, I apologize for ruining that for you, because I'm thinking, here's a story about destruction. Here you go, kids, set in the nursery, and you can remind yourself that God killed everybody because of their sins previously. You get the book of Numbers, and those books, it's like they're marching around, and you know from the start it's about everyone dying. So that manna from heaven, it's great and everything, but it just sort of fed you until eventually you died off of something while you're marching around. And so Jesus is going to speak about being the bread of heaven, the one who comes down. And then the idea is, what exactly is the point of that? The signs of these deeper meanings. These are miraculous things. Well, in chapter 6, the deeper meaning is, he's going to say, I'm the bread of life. You must eat my body and drink my blood. Otherwise, you're not going to experience salvation. Eat his body and drink his blood is not Lord's Supper talk. He tells you that it's coming to him and believing in him. But his point is this whole idea of, this should have proven something deeper about me, that I'm the one who can satisfy, unlike the manna we had in the Old Testament. That's sort of the point we have there. So you have these signs that take place. Chapter 11, when you get the raising of Lazarus and the whole story that goes along there, in which he shows up and Lazarus is dead and he stinks and he raised him from the dead. And he says, I'm the resurrection and the life. He's trying to show you by the raising of the dead that he can raise you from the dead, both spiritual dead but also physical dead. Those who believe in him will die no more. There's this deeper significance beyond just simply, hey, he did this, he can do that. It's, what does it mean that he can do that? That's what I love about John's gospel is, John is simple in its story, even simple in his Greek. Anytime you have like a first-year Greek student, they're always like, I'm translating John. I'm like, yeah, because he uses five different words. It's easy to kind of walk through John. It's that way. It's simple, but John is not simple in his writing. John is simple for the purpose of allowing you to think deeper about what does this mean. It's a thinking man's gospel, I say, because John's wanting you to say, okay, here's the story, but what does it mean behind the story? And what John's trying to get across is, these signs are proving something about the nature of Jesus that should lead to the conclusion to say, he's the Christ, the Son of God. That's what each of these signs is meant to do. And as you build up on those, you're supposed to be sort of working your way through this and saying, here's a sign and there's a sign. There are signs all over the place. So John has miraculous signs. But he also has what I would call unmiraculous signs. Things that Jesus does that have deep significance and deeper truths, but yet they're not necessarily a miracle. And I'll take back to chapter 2, which I think introduces us to signs in both a miraculous and a non-miraculous way. You get the turning of water into wine, which normally in Bible class is us spending hours on things that they wouldn't have cared about, like, what was the alcoholic content of that particular thing here? And what was their distillation? Like, it's like, I don't think John cared about that. That was not his point here. And you get that sign taking place. But it follows up with another sign that's not miraculous, and that is the sign of the temple, where he stops for a moment and says, man, look at this great building. 3 days I'll tear this up and something greater is here. What do you mean 3 days this is going to happen? Well, there's a sign there that they're going to see about something better coming in the future. And we're going to jump back into chapter 2 at the end of this, which my thing is the coolest thing we have in the Gospel of John that I want to jump into. But you have these signs, and all these signs point towards, this guy can do that, but what does that mean? okay, you did this. What does that mean? And what does John want you to think it means? It means he must be the Christ, the Son of God. This is kind of John's point there. So you have signs, you have testimony. Chapter 5, verse 33 is the chapter of testimonies, where Jesus says, if I testify about myself, it doesn't count. Which is not like, he's not saying, you guys know I'm a liar, so you won't matter. But in sort of ancient Jewish idea, you couldn't just give a testimony about yourself. Which makes sense. If I walk into the bank and say, hello, bankers, I'm worth $10 million, give me lots of money. They're going to say, can you prove that at all? And I say, well, I just testified about myself. And they're going to ask for something better. You can try that. They'll probably arrest you that you're trying to steal something. But you can go in and it doesn't work. So he talks about testimonies. He lays out things like the Father, that he's a testimony, the miracles are testimonies, the works that he does are testimonies. And he kind of lays out this idea of, here are the testimony that proves who I am. And so he's going to walk through and say, there are testimonies. There's God's miracles. There's the miracles he's due. There's God saying, my beloved Son. There's the scriptures, which, let me stop here and just sort of give a warning for those of us here on 8 in the morning Bible class on Saturday. There's a warning in John 5 that always scares me. Verse 37, he says, you search the scriptures, believing that in them you'll have life, and they point of me, and you missed me. And there's always that reminder of the purpose of scripture is still to get us to Jesus at some point and make sure we don't miss him. But there's testimony of scriptures. There's Moses. Basically, he's saying all these people testify of who I am. But even before that, chapter 1, you get a testimony of Nathanael who goes, make sure I get the names right, is it Andrew or Nathanael? One of them goes to the other, Philip and Nathanael go to each other, and they say, come see the one who is the hope of Israel. This is the Messiah. And then he shows up and he says, I saw you underneath that tree. You are an Israelite indeed. You're truly a genuine Israelite. And he says, wow, I'm amazed. You're the Lord, you're the God. And the follow-up by Jesus says, you thought that was cool. Just wait and see what else I can do. And you're going to have more evidence of that. You get that in chapter 1. Or in chapter 3, you've got a Pharisee, or a member of the Sanhedrin named Nicodemus, who shows up. Here's a powerful man, one of the top 72 men in Israel, who comes at night, who recognizes that Jesus is a teacher who has come from God at this moment in time. By the end of the Gospel of John, he's with Joseph of Arimathea. I think he's a disciple who takes the body. You got him in chapter 3. What a great testimony. You got this guy who's well-respected, who looks and says, this guy is something different. He's a teacher come from God. Chapter 4, another testimony, not quite the same type. You got a woman who's had multiple husbands. You've had 5. The man you're with is not your husband. And so on that story, she goes to Samaria and says, behold, I found a man who told me everything about myself. Come and see. I always want to stop and think, what's the crowd reaction? Like, you sure everything? Like, does he know 5 and the 1 and all that? You know, does he have all those stories down? And at the end of that, they say, at first we came because of her testimony, but now we believe that you are truly the Messiah. This concept here of individuals who encounter Jesus, they see him, they give testimony about him, they lay it out and say, yes, this man is truly who he claims to be. Or my personal favorite is John chapter 9, the man who's born blind. And the disciples argue, you know, why is he born blind? Was it his parents' fault? You know, was it his fault? And Jesus says, wrong question, which... I think we do a lot of that in our Bible study and just in life in general. Where I think God looks down and thinks, why are you guys talking? I remember like a guy could like knock and say, it's a dumb conversation. Move on to something else there. But hey, that's the wrong question. You are here to work the things of God while it's still light. And so you got this chapter 9 section to where he's walking it through and the Pharisees, you know, this blind man's healed and they say, well, he can't do, he's of the devil. And the parents say he's of age because they're cowards, don't want to give the testimony. But the blind man says, look, whether he's a sinner or not, you guys fight amongst yourself. I'm blind and I now can see. And that's one of those powerful, like, you guys work this stuff out, but here's what I know and here's what happened to me. And therefore, there's something about this particular man that's unique. And you get that testimony. Or the one where we sort of hammer, you know, Thomas in John 20. You know, we call him Doubting Thomas, but really he has the most powerful confession in the entire Gospel of John. And what's amazing to me is John uses him as the conclusion to his story. 21 is an epilogue, it's sort of an attachment, but the very last person who's going to make the most powerful statement and testimony regarding Thomas is the guy we sort of hammer on as Doubting Thomas, who by the way, is not any more doubting the other disciples. They all asked to touch and feel. He just was the last one to do it. So he shows up, he touches and feels, he says, my Lord and my God. That testimony, this is the resurrected Lord, and now I'm going to submit my life to him. You have these testimonies, and there's a lot more in the Gospels of John, to where he's going to say, these people witnessed Jesus, and here's what they declared about him. They declared he's Lord, God, Messiah, you know, the hope of Israel. That was their testimony based upon what they're able to see. So you get signs, you get testimony. The third thing you get is personal witness. These I am statements where Jesus talks about I am this or I am that. There are 13 of them in John. We only talk about the seven I am statements. I did a study like 7 years ago, and I like read through them, like, well, there's 13. Why do we only have seven? I don't know. Somebody chose seven. We're cooler than 13. I think the seven is probably because they're connected with some miracle. With others, it's like Jesus saying, I am a teacher. And they don't have it the same way. But you got these sections where Jesus says, let me just tell you about myself. And they fall into two big categories. The first category is the John chapter 8 I am statement, where in John 8:24 it says, unless you believe that I am, you will die in your sins. And in John 8:58, before Abraham was, I am. And you get those two together, and I think you have Jesus making a declaration of deity, where he is claiming not just to be somebody who's been around for a few years, but he's claiming the divine nature. And they got that because they picked up large rocks to kill him at that moment in time, because he was making a claim of deity. Even John 8 is, Jesus has a group of Jewish people who have some sense of belief. He says, speaking of the Jews who believe, by the end of that chapter, those same people are about to kill him, so they don't have a deep belief. And he walks them through sort of their need for salvation and walks them through his particular greatness. And then he talks about being greater than Abraham, and they say, how can you be greater than Abraham? You're less than 50. You know, their mindset, the older you were, the better you were. We're a youth culture, like it's cool to be young and hip and whatnot. And their culture was, the grayer you were, the more prominence you should have. And as a guy who's 34 but graying really rapidly, I like that idea of the grayer you are, the better you are there. But they have that whole story there taking place. And he says, you get it. I am greater than Abraham, because before he was existed, I did. Now, I always forget how old Abraham is at this point. I think it's 2,500 years. It's old. You know, it's more than like 10. So it's old time there. You know, my kids, talking about like dates and ages, my 7-year-old came to me yesterday, it was like 2 weeks ago, and she came up and she said, Papa, whenever you were a kid, did you have TV? I was like, yes, I did. Thanks for that. She goes, did it have color yet? I'm like, yes, I've always had color TV. Thank you, though, for thinking I'm... For those of you who did have color TV, I'm not calling you old, but it just appeared to be old if you didn't have color TV in her mind there. But see, that was the idea. But he's obviously saying I'm older than Abraham. So this I am statement in John 8 is a claim of divinity coming out of Exodus chapter 3, which John plays off of Exodus a ton. So don't miss that idea. The rest of the I am statements are things like I am the bread of life, I am the living water, I am the light of the world. Here's what John's doing with those. Each of those are things we need. If you're looking for spiritual sustenance, you have to come to Jesus and believe in him. If you're looking for living water, he's your only source. If you're looking for light in a dark world, he's the light of the world. If you're looking over in sections with regards to a resurrection and life, he is that way. If you're looking for the way, the truth, the life, it's Jesus. And the sort of the I am statements you have here go into two categories. He is God. And the other category is you need him. And those two things I think are being emphasized by Jesus is that I am this unique Son of God, but also that you need me so that you'll be willing to make that commitment to follow after me. And a lot of times I am statements are connected with signs, sometimes miraculous, like the feeding of the 5,000, the raising of Lazarus, sometimes non-miraculous. When he says, I am the light of the world, that's not a miracle. They're at the Feast of Lights, and you look around, and everybody has their lights up. I'm trying to think of the name of the... What do they have at Hanukkah? What's the lights? Menorah. They have those up. So you look around, there's like, I'm the light. You see these lights? I'm the light of the world. That's not miraculous, but it's a sign. Look deeper and you're going to see something about me that's greater truth. And so you get these in John's gospel. But from my standpoint, they have two big points. I'm God and you need me. Unless you believe that I am, you will die in my sins. I think that takes in both of those in a pretty powerful way, that he's God and that you need him. And John's got this personal witness of Jesus himself making these I am statements throughout the gospel. Another cool thing you have is you have the controlling of time, to where John's going to lay out and basically say Jesus is able to set the course of when he's going to die, which is not what any of us can do. And so I think it gives this divine, again, a divine sort of connection to Jesus there. I've got, how much time do I have? I may have a watch. My phone decided not to work. All right. I'm going to skip and jump to something and might come back to something else. John will spend a lot of time in responses. I'll give you a quick overview. John 9, to me, is the chapter on responses. There are three types. There's the Jewish leaders who, no matter the evidence, are going to reject. Oh, he healed you and you're blind? That's because he's a sinner. The devil did it. Or he didn't actually do it. You weren't really blind. Or chapter 11, where they say, Lazarus is walking around. We got to kill Lazarus and this guy because there's no way of denying this. Some folks' response to Jesus is, you can give me all the evidence in the world. I'm not going to care. Some folks are cowardly. The parents are brought for testimony. And instead of saying, yes, my son was blind, and yes, Jesus healed him, which the text says they believed. It says out of fear of the Jews, they simply said, he's of age, you ask him. And how many times in our life do we have situations where we could probably say something a little more emphatic about Jesus, but we don't lie and we don't necessarily deny him, but we are cowardly. And there's that sort of response in faith that way. And then you got the blind man who basically says, I don't know about all this other stuff, but I know he's blind and I was blind and I can see. I think I mentioned this yesterday about some of my faith stuff early on with Emmett, to where I was kind of at that point. I don't know this other stuff and how God allows certain things to happen to certain people, but I do know that the grave was empty and Jesus was raised, and so I've got to deal with that in my life because I think that's truth there. So you get that response. You get the John 20 verse 28 response, where you have the my Lord and my God, where you have somebody who's laying out this is who it is. You get a John 21 response, where you've got a Peter and John comparison that's being made, to where John seems to be the steady disciple who has followed Jesus' entire life, start to finish, and Peter's having to be invited back into the fold. Now, there are two ways of reading John 21, and there's big discussions on which way. I tend to think that this is not Jesus inviting Peter back in some, three times he denied, three times this. It seems to be more confrontational than that, and the idea that Peter is saddened about this, and I think John leaves John 21 open-ended, to where we don't know what Peter's going to do, but we do because it's, we know the rest of the story, and Peter becomes us. That Peter is in place of us. You've had this evidence. What will you follow him or not? What are you going to do in response to this? And so you got that John 21 responses that take place. So those are the three big responses from the gospel. It's a gospel about wanting belief. And so obviously all three responses are related to how do you believe? How do you put your trust in? Do you reject it? Are you cowardly? Are you legitimate belief? Do you declare my Lord and my God? Are you out there to serve him? What is your response? That's what the gospel wants. Second thing, this is the last thing I want to talk about. And this is one of those like, it's really cool and probably doesn't flow in my argument, but it's just cool. I like sharing cool things because my wife gets tired of hearing them. And she's like, yeah, that's, I don't know if you have wives like mine, but she has the look and the way to respond where it's like, yeah, that's great, honey. Like the pat on the head of your child, like, good job. Go do something else now. Like, that's great. Can you go take the trash out? That's the, the look here. So she gets this stuff and that's her response. So maybe you think it's cooler. But John 1 and 2, actually, John 1, 2, and 3 set up the narrative of the Gospel of John in a way that I don't want you to miss. John chapter 1, verse 1 starts with what three words? In the beginning. What other verse starts with what? But those three words? Genesis 1. I don't think John is trying to be too cute there. I think he's making a clear point. What Jesus is doing is bringing about a new creation. The word new becomes a key idea throughout the first three chapters. John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word, the Word was with God. He is retelling the story of creation and saying, Jesus is bringing something new. You think about Israel's story, it's creation and Exodus. John the Baptist, when it's time for him to make a declaration about Jesus, what phrase does he use? Behold the Lamb of God. When you follow through the Gospel of John, you have Passovers being numbered. We talk about Jesus being a minister for 3.5 years, we get that because of John. John names the Passovers. When it comes time for Jesus to die, there is a meticulous sort of reading in 18 and 19 of making sure he dies with no fault. There's no blemish. And then there's a quotation when they don't break his legs that's from Exodus saying he is this Passover lamb. What John is doing is showing us that Jesus is the new creation and the new Passover. That's chapter 1. We've got this new creation, this new Passover. Chapter 2. Water into wine, this temple. They have this water, or they have the first drinking of the wine, and then they have this new thing that Jesus does. The key person in that story is the taster, who shows up and says, this is weird. The new is better than the old. The point of that sign, is not how much alcohol content is in there. The point of that sign is this new thing Jesus is doing is better than the old thing. The old world, the old creation, the old Exodus, as good as it might be, what Jesus is doing is new and better. Next sign, that same chapter, you have the destroying of the temple, which is a symbol of the old order, and then a raising up of a new temple in 3 days. What's that new temple? Well, the text says the disciples remembered him saying that and said, this is in reference to his body that was raised up. The new temple is better than the old one. Then how does chapter 3 begin? Nicodemus comes at night. You're a teacher who's come from God. And Jesus says, that's great, Nicodemus, but you must be born anew. All of us are born into this old world. We came out of our mother's womb in this old world. But Jesus is inviting us into a new world, new creation, a new Exodus. And this new world is better than the old one. But for us to join this new world, we have to be born again or born anew. There's a Greek word that means either one there. And this idea of you've got to now participate in this new world that Jesus is doing and all the things that go along with that. That's another sort of thing that's cool, at least for me, in the Gospel of John, this idea of there's this new thing that Jesus is doing, and you've got to get on board with this new thing if you're going to experience the blessings that go along with the new creation and the new Exodus.